Welcome back to another episode of PS Voice. Joining us today is Paula Subaki, a senior research fellow at the think tank Chatham House, a visiting professor at the University of Bologna, and an expert on global governance institutions. In this episode, Subaki is joined by former editor of The Economist, John Andrews, to discuss economic stagnation in the southern Eurozone countries, China's economic outlook, and London's future after Brexit. In this section, we discuss Trump and the world economy.
Andre, you kick off the meeting.
Mario Draghi and Janet Yellen used their speeches in Jackson Hole to address the theme of the dangers of loosening regulation on banks and financial markets, as we know is on the agenda of the Trump administration. 10 years after the beginnings of the crisis, are we already forgetting the lessons of the crisis? Is there the risk of deregulation?
Well, I will say there is a risk there when we are forgetting the lesson of the crisis. I think there is a very different agenda from the Trump administration. And I think, again, I think we need to learn more about regulations. I think, again, after the crisis, there have been this attempt to create a more than regulation, say, very importantly, a financial safety net, which is something that needed to be strengthened and improved. And I think we need to understand better the relationship and the links between, say, macroeconomic policies and macroprudential regulations. There have been some steps done, but I think more needs to be done. And I think we need to really come out of this black and white situation where we need rules, we don't need rules. I think we need to understand why rules are and what are for, and how rules talk to the macroeconomic context.
Is there a risk, though, that there'll be a divergence between the rules in the US and the rules in the rest of the world, particularly in Europe?
Yeah, there is this clear problem. And again, one of the issues that were addressed after the crisis, and particularly at the level of global governance, let's say the G20 effort with the Financial Stability Board, was exactly to try to create a sort of level playing field where countries, and particularly the major the countries with the largest and the most important financial centres, could get together and really set up a common set of rules.
But maybe there is still some time needed to have more research into the impact of the regulation that has been put in place in the last years. Do you believe that we still need more time to understand if we've gone maybe too far in this regulation?
We need to understand better. I'm not saying that we've gone too far, but I think definitely we need to understand better what is the impact on rules. And again, one of the issues which were discussed at the time of banking crisis in Europe was exactly this. Banks were saying, well, rules are actually constraining. They are too draconian, they are constraining our profitability. And so this is something that needs to be addressed and thought through rather than say these are the rules, this is the sort of straitjacket and everybody needs to adapt to that. So I think, but from there, from say we need to understand how to get a flexible, adjustable and resilient regulatory framework, and from there to jump and say we don't need rules and we just get rid of them, I don't think that is it's a good step forward.
David, what's your view on this? What do you think?
Do you think it's right that the increase in capital requirements did choke off lending in, well, particularly in Europe?
Well, there is evidence, and banks say, it's something I've never worked on. I don't know. I don't have data. Yeah. But banks claim that this is the case. Perhaps we need an inquiry, at least in Europe, to understand the impact of these rules. Yeah. Again, it was something that was somehow decided, and you say, well, tick in the box, that we need to increase the capital requirement, box ticked. And so what is the impact on this and which are the different level? Because not every financial institution is the same.
I'd like to mention your last article for Project Syndicate, where you say that Trump's America First could deal a massive blow to the institutions that underpin the global monetary system. Is this really likely to happen? What can be the consequences?
Trump has attacked basically every multilateral institution except those two that are down on Pennsylvania Road in Avenue in Washington, which are the World Bank and the IMF. There is still time, exactly. But you know, he did NATO, he did everything else except NAFTA, those two, NAFTA, and they named them. Yeah. So and these are two institutions where actually the others, more like security and defense, where the United States are bankrolling these institutions, the main shareholder of both the World Bank and the IMF, for historical reasons and for lots of different reasons, but that's the reality. So it's interesting to think, first of all, the question is he going to do something about it? Is he going to turn to them and say, well, we're not interested anymore in supporting this institution? There is a precedent, Congress took almost 5 years to approve the quota reform in the IMF, and it was quite embarrassing. So, you know, what will happen? What is next? I think it's interesting to think then this is part of the, you know, rethinking the role of the United States in the world. The reality is then with Trump, the United States has become a reluctant hegemon. And that goes very much in terms of providing public goods like security and defense and peace, if you like, but also to bankrolling the financial stability. And so what will happen? Difficult to say at the moment. Obviously, there are some obligations as well as privileges in being part of these institutions. But the interesting thing is what the big emerging market economy, which is China, will do.
And now, China's global economic role.
I mean, it's kind of ironic that at the G20, it was China defending the idea of free trade, not the United States, and the United States being put in the sort of protectionist corner, and China, you know, the great exponent of open free markets. What's your view on how the Chinese role will develop?
Well, again,
and in particular, I mean, you know, take the renminbi. Will that be internationalized?
The plan to internationalize the renminbi is been going on for, you know, China has had this plan since 2009, 2010, and it comes like is out of necessity. And again, after the global financial crisis, the governor of the People's Bank of China, the central bank, made a speech say, oh, actually, we need to move away from an international monetary system which is centered on a national currency. And it was very vague. He didn't mention the dollar. He didn't mention any solution. He opened the door to, I would say, a sort of global currency.
Do you feel that really China remains a mercantilist country? And that it will take...
I wouldn't use mercantilist country, but it's a country which controls and manages its exchange rate because it has a very tough economic target, which is GDP growth.
But part of the strategy is to use international financial centres like London to stimulate demand for renminbi denominated assets. And that sort of faltered over the last couple of years, partly because of the depreciation of the renminbi. But now the dollar has weakened. Is that picking up again? And do you see that as a viable strategy going forward, given that actually they've been reforming their domestic financial system, which maybe means there isn't going to be such demand for offshore assets?
Yeah. The strategy is viable because it underpins a system which it remains close. So the capital account of China remains controlled. Like, it's been liberalized since 2009, but it's not an open capital account. So that is, and plus they reintroduced capital control very recently. So it's viable because the financial center is a way to somehow create an asset, an RMB asset, and allows the movement the inflow and outflows around RMB outside and away from the domestic market. So not sort of threat to financial stability, domestic financial stability for China.
Is there any way for them to internationalize their RMB without sort of involving international centers like London and therefore benefiting international centers like London? I mean, is there any alternative? Really?
They do. They have already alternative. In fact, actually, I think the big, if you like, so the increase in financial center, particularly Hong Kong, was in the first 5 years of this internationalization. They have been experimented with other ways of attracting inflows and controlling outflows under obviously controlled conditions. And these are the free trade zones that they introduced, for example, in Shanghai, where they've been experimenting with open capital account. So they do these things. And I think going forward, I think financial centers like Hong Kong will be less important, while, you know, and particularly if the RMB will internationalize more, financial center like London will become more important because it's outside China, and eventually it will become a pure financial, a pure offshore center, like the euro dollar market here, right?
In this section, we discuss Brexit.
There's an argument that supporters of Brexit put forward that that the benefits of the freedom to do free trade deals with non-EU countries will offset the impact of more restricted access to EU markets. Is that possible or probable?
Well, it depends. It depends what the EU thinks about this, because the EU has been very clear. The UK cannot start any kind of negotiation until they have come out of the EU. It depends on the country. The thing is, the large markets, which are those that make a difference for the UK, are already somehow engaged with the EU. So it become really, you know, somehow it will have to go through the EU or some of the deals that the EU has already. For example, the recent FTA agreement with Japan. China, interesting, you mentioned the offshore market. Interesting, there are two offshore markets, RMB offshore market in Europe. One is London, the other one is Frankfurt. And again, in terms of inflows of RMB from trade, deposit and so on, Frankfurt is stronger than London because trade between the Germany and China is much larger than between China and the United Kingdom. So the United Kingdom, in London centre, is strong in terms of financial transactions. So, and that really says a lot about the ambition and the hope of being able to engage with China and, you know, create a viable and strong import and export.
So, I mean, interesting. I mean, there's relatively little trade, I suppose, given the size of the economy, between Britain and China, apart from financial services. What would be the impact of a Brexit, which was a hard Brexit? How do you see the British economy doing?
It's very difficult to make any prediction, and I really refrain to do that because, for the same reason, we don't know what will be the end game here.
WTO rules will be
Let's put it this way. There is a transition period, and there will be some years between, coming out of the EU and establishing a new regime, which is not only with the EU, but generally a new setup. And there will be these years of transitions because you can't really establish, this takes time. And those years will be really difficult. Yeah. Then after that, let's say maybe in 20 years' time, maybe the UK economy will prosper, will be fantastic. But is that medium to long-term
period? I could be
period.
In my grave by then. It's not very happy prospect.
And last, we go into the status of Italy.
Moderate pro-European parties were able to win most elections in Europe. And at some point, everyone was talking about Italy and the five-star movements. Now we don't talk about that so much because maybe this fear of these populist movements in Europe has receded. But what do you think will happen in Italy?
Well, let me go back to the economy. Italy is a sick man of Europe in the sense, but this is actually something common to many Eurozone countries, except Germany, is the fact that the economy grows, there is a recovery without job creation. Mm. And that is problematic. And that really poses a huge political issue. And that is the case of Italy. And in fact, now the economy looks quite, the outlook will look quite bright, but again, no jobs. And young people move somewhere else. They emigrate to other countries. Now, I'm happy to make a prediction, and I think the Five Stars movement has peaked and is going to slow down because they lost credibility in terms of, in particular, the local government like Rome, where Rome now is a city completely, you know, chaotic. The government of the Five Star proved complete and effective. But I'm very concerned about what is the hard right, so Northern League, which is now becoming more a national party.
There was an FT article the other day predicting an alliance between the Northern League and Berlusconi.
And that is a possibility, and that will be, and plus the other bit of the right. Mm-hmm. So, and migration at the moment is the key variable, factors which will determine the election next year in Italy. And obviously the employment, which goes together, all the social and the fact that people feel the inequality. But
with these alliances, political alliance taking shape, do you believe that there's the risk of Italy having again years and years of fragmented governments, short-lived governments?
What I'm concerned is, first of all, whether there will be enough, support for a government like this to, out. And maybe the risk is to be like in 2013 when there wasn't a clear winner and it was really difficult with like several weeks without a government.
But the return of Berlusconi, how would the markets react to that?
I don't think it would be very good. But in particular because there will be uncertainty, because they won't be able, I don't think they will come up with, if they have a majority, it would be a really just about, or we'll have to get some, you know, a coalition, as always, to govern. It would be a government without any competence. And because, again, the Northern League doesn't have experience in government. So it is going to be really problematic, and that really will create some disturbance in the markets.
Let me ask David and Andre. David first. What other questions would you put to Paolo?
Well, on the Eurozone, how do you rate the chances of Macron being able to push through reforms to the Eurozone, which will require involving more sort of central coordination one way or another? What are the chances, and how important is that to put the Eurozone on a stronger long-term footing?
Well, it is fundamental to put the Eurozone on a long-term trajectory. We know what is needed to be done, i.e. a fiscal union, but it is politically very difficult. I think the interesting thing is that Germany has realised, and for them is more important, the unity of the EU and the Eurozone is more important than some of the issues they had in the past year, like fiscal discipline, although they haven't completely given up on fiscal discipline, but they are a bit softened up. I think the chances of Macron are linked to the chances of Merkel to be elected. So if Merkel is elected, the duo Macron and Merkel would be really good news for Europe, because I think the two together, with their problems and their drawbacks, but they will able to do something in Europe.
Andre,
Mr. Macron, is his popularity has been coming down quite strongly quite dramatically in the last weeks. Are you confident that he will actually be capable of putting his reforms in practice?
He's inexperienced in politics, in government. I think is a clever guy, and I think he probably will learn from his mistakes, and maybe he will do something to improve his communication. But obviously, he will have to compromise, because everybody has to compromise in France. He will have to reconsider some of his programs and be less ambitious and just get some, at least some reforms. And
Paola, let me ask you a final question. We've covered an awful lot of ground, China all the way to Brexit, etc. In 5 years' time, would you be more optimistic about the EU than a Brexited Britain, or the reverse?
I'm a EU national, so obviously I'm biased here.
Paola, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
David, thank you so much. Andre, thank you very much indeed for all of you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to PS Voice. Go beyond the news with Project Syndicate by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and by reading our greatest minds at www.project-syndicate.org.